you know, staff come in the morning and they read their messages and they have the briefing with the admiral. And I'm from over the best, you know, and I say, here's how the war is going. Not based on anything they knew firsthand, but based on the messages that they had read. And they talk about things. And then people would head out for lunch, and they'd play tennis in the afternoon and then come back. Somehow all that had stopped. Their whole life, style in Saigon, ended. And it was turned up, you know, somehow changed the culture. We're over here fighting a war. We got to get this thing turned over to the Vietnamese. There's no time for tennis. There's no time for, you know, for long lunches. There's no time for. Besides, he gave them all so much to do, and they expected them to do it.
Now, right?
Yeah, this afternoon. Give me the answer this afternoon. You have dinner and go back to the office. This is not something anybody has ever done before.
Given the situation where Admiral Zumwalt will pretty quickly turn it around, where Abrams respected him, and not only respected him, but went to bat for him, I suppose, as well. When Admiral Zumwalt is establishing operations like the different various parts of Sea Lords, what, from your position, when you're observing these things, problems of coordination with the Army, when you're setting up operations, are there things that have to be smoothed over here, and if so, how did that work? If you're trying to get, you know, cooperation on an operation, artillery support, or going into an operation with ground forces.
Well, I don't know that I can speak to that firsthand. That was really something that would generally be, you know, wouldn't be coordinated in Saigon. That has to be done down in the field. But I don't remember a lot of that. You know, we basically did things that we could do in-house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had the organic support to achieve. One of the first things that struck me was when I went to the early briefings before the Admiral took over, and we had finished our trip around the country, and we went to a couple morning NAV4V briefings. And they had these maps of Vietnam, and they had colors. This is where the enemy lines are, and here's where our lines are. Of course, I had just finished 2 years at Fletcher, where we had studied guerrilla warfare, and there weren't any lines.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting there thinking to myself, What the hell's going on here? There's not, we can't say this is everything on this side is the enemy and everything on this side are the good guys. So we were kind of mired in another point I want to make, in a thought process that wasn't even applicable.
And this is another thing that had to be shaken up.
Yeah, I mean, you had to change people's view of this whole thing. This wasn't World War II. Occupy it during the day, but at night it was occupied by somebody else, or you might think you occupied it, but you didn't. In a broad sense, the Americans, you know, we never did understand the true nature of this war, What the staff was doing in Saigon was very classical, traditional, you know, military approach to briefings, and to the extent that briefings resulted in decision-making, you know, support for decision-making. And yesterday we moved. We had a firefight here, and we took this area, not realizing that as soon as we left, the VC moved back in. We hadn't taken anything.
Sure, it was the same with the helicopter operations of the Army.
Exactly. You know, and so so all that had to change. But getting the forces involved, the Sea Lords and the Slingshot and those things, were easier than the turning things over to the Vietnamese. That was the more complicated.
Sure.
Because that required, see, the other thing is that you noticed when you got there was the operations were all U.S. This was U.S. work. Where the hell were the Vietnamese? When you had to deal with the Vietnamese, when you had to get them to do something, where it required their coordination, where it required their participation, that's when things got difficult and complicated.
One of the examples I remember from talking to both Admiral Zimbalt and Admiral Tidd was, and you may have been on this trip, which is why I'll ask you, they flew down at the very southern end of South Vietnam to look at the spot where they were going to put Seafloat. And the Army Corps commander, you know, poo-pooed the whole thing, said that's a disaster waiting to happen, and Admiral Zumwalt, in effect, had to go over his head to Abrams to get the thing done.
Yeah, I was there.
I mean, what's your memory of that discussion, that whole...
Same thing. But that wasn't an illogical conclusion to come from. You were setting this thing right in the center of the VC or all around it. And you could easily come to the conclusion that this was an outpost that was couldn't be there very long. Mm. You know, you can't put something in the center of the, you know, it's like putting a fort in the middle of Indian Territory, you know, pretty soon, it's not going to be there. And Zumwalt had to go to Abrams to get permission to do that. The guys couldn't believe that he was even considering it. Zumwalt prevailed, and the whole thing, turned into a success.
I guess Admiral Zumwalt never had the sense that, oh my God, this is a bad thing. I mean, this is in effect the middle of Indian Country, and...
Well, but also, you got to understand that Zumwalt was a risk taker. His mindset was, how are we going to get the United States Navy involved? Remember, I go back to these original things. We've got to deploy our forces. We've got to tell the enemy that there isn't any place in Vietnam where we're not going to establish a presence. So even if in the back of his own mind he thought it, he might have agreed with what that Army guy was saying, but he was willing to take that risk.
Mm-hmm. So we're gonna do this anyway.
We're gonna do it anyway because it was important.
So
you could find a reason to this is the way the Navy was. There was always a reason not to do something. It's too risky. I remember, I'll give you one that triggers my memory. Told you that the type commanders in California supported the equipment. So we had a type commander that was an amphibious type commander. He was in charge of all the amphibious ships in the Navy. But he also supported many of the craft that we had in country. Mm-hmm. Supported them in the sense that they were responsible for making them ready to go to Vietnam, training the crews, providing spare parts, support, that type of thing. We got a message one day from this type commander criticizing us because the PBR boats in the Delta were behind on the preventative maintenance schedule. So Zumwalt got there, they were sitting around doing their preventative maintenance. Zumwalt said, you get off your ass and get out there and patrol. firefights and, you know, do the things that we have to do. I don't give a goddamn about preventive maintenance. By the way, we looked it up and a couple of those boats had been sunk. So, yeah, they were behind on their preventive maintenance. But that was a mentality. I remember this because I was struck by the mentality back in the States. What the hell did they think we were doing?
They were just concerned that the ledger sheets were balanced out, right? And this is not something that can necessarily happen when you're fighting a war.
That's right. But also, if you would have written up what Zumwalt wanted to do and put it in seafloor down, and set it up a chain of command, said, here's what I'm thinking about doing, well, what do you think? You've got to be out of your mind. We're not going to support that. We may lose that asset. But in wars, you lose assets.
Sure.
People get killed. Things get bombed. Things get, you know. And it's not the role of wartime to this is not an asset prevention effort. You've got to employ those assets, understanding that there's risks associated with that. Zumwalt was willing to take, in that sense, he was an entrepreneur, you see, with that entrepreneur attitude, where as opposed to people who was thinking they'd become ossified, you know, so highly bureaucratic. You know, someone used to say that one of the basic problems of bureaucracy is that there's too many people who can say no and too few who can say yes. So if you ask a bureaucracy if you ought to do something, they're going to generally tell you no. Zumwalt had an inherent dislike and distrust of bureaucracies as a leader and as a decision maker. So, as was his pattern, was he always kept a group of people around him that he could use to bypass the bureaucracy. That's a role that I played.
To bypass the bureaucracy.
In other words, if you wanted to get something done, I mean, I even, you know, when I was back here in Washington with him when he was CNO, he did the same thing. He always kept a private group of people, you know, that, you know, while the bureaucracy was studying something, he'd have them study it overnight.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have an inherent distrust of what the bureaucracy would bring forward. Generally, it would tell him he couldn't do something that he wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
that he thought should be done.
So, obviously, it's this innovative approach that he takes to problem solving, the fact that he makes a name for himself because he turns the Navy around in Vietnam and gains a great deal of respect for so doing. This is one of the main reasons why the higher-ups in the Navy identify him, even though he's young, even though he hasn't had the fleet command or the four-star position that this man is going to be ideal for CNO.
Well, the Navy didn't come to that conclusion.
Right, the secretary.
See, the Navy told him that, I remember a letter he got from me, telling him that they were going to give him the 7th Fleet. He was going to be the first surface officer to ever command the 7th Fleet. Nothing but a flyer had commanded that since the Second World War. That's what the Navy was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But see, in addition to making a name for himself with laborers, after Nixon was elected, Melvin Laird was named Secretary of Defense. And he made his first visit to Vietnam in spring of 69, you know, sometime in that time. Nixon had been inaugurated in January. He probably came over in March. And Some of that wasn't even on the agenda. I mean, the Navy wasn't even on the agenda.
Even after all this that's gone by.
It wasn't even on the agenda. So, somehow it goes to Abrams, which is, they would like to let Secretary Hollis come in all the way. So, Abrams says, well, I'm not going to set up a private meeting, but he said, if you want to go down to Camp Toe, or I forget where it was, where the Army guys down there were going to brief him, we'll put you on the agenda. We worked on that presentation for 2 or 3 days. Somewhat went down there and really pissed off the Army guy. This is basically, the Army guy had been led to believe by Abrams that Somewhat was just coming down to meet the Secretary, you know. Well, Somewhat took over the whole damn briefing. Basically turned it into a Navy presentation, which really pisses the hell off. The other thing that happened was Somewhat became a favorite of the press. Because he was good looking, he was energetic, he was young, he was bright, he was all these things.
He went out to the field and pinned the decorations on and handed the beer out.
And then they found him to be exciting and interesting, you see. And they started paying attention to what the Navy was doing, press day.
I guess he was more their image of what an actual commander is, as opposed to what the other commanders seem to have been, that is, managers or bureaucrats, more than actual leaders of men.
Well, Beth was not just managing a bureaucrat. I mean, he had, which was well established before we got there. He was having quite a few afternoon liaisons with Vietnamese ladies over at the house. He'd be gone from 1 to 4 in the afternoon.
Admiral Beth,
yeah. I mean, I don't know that firsthand, but I mean, that was people would telling me, because I was living in the same house. Mm-hmm. See, nobody was allowed in the house between 1 and 4 o'clock. So Abrams probably knew about that. I mean, you know, this whole image of this Navy guy. So here comes Zumbach. Bright, young, aggressive, interesting, you know, everything that this guy was not.
Right.
And in fact, everything that the rest of the Navy wasn't either.
So it was when Admiral Zumwalt took over this thing that he, I guess, made this impression on Laird and planted the...
Oh, yeah. He made a big impression on Laird. He made an impression on Abrams, on everybody that counted. But the Navy wasn't going to push him. The Navy was run by flyers. Mm-hmm. The guy that was going to be the next CNO was Highland, who was sent back fleet. Mm-hmm. That's the first guy Zumwalt fired after he became sent CNO, was Admiral Highland. There was no way that this guy that had been ship canned to Vietnam was going to, 2 years later, end up being CNO. But when they decided he had made a name for himself in Vietnam, he was supporting the policy of getting things turned over, and so they decided to interview him. And when Kissinger interviewed him, his response was, I found a naval officer with some intelligence. But I don't know the story of his becoming Vietnam.
That was done very quietly, though, even at the time. But I suppose because of your position, you knew the reason why he had gone back, whereas most people didn't.
That's right. But I had left Vietnam by then.
Oh, really?
But we kept in touch.
Oh, you did not stay for the full time that he did then? Did you just have a year tour?
I had a little over a year, and then I went to, and I left.
I remember him telling me that he was ordered to go to Washington in civilian clothes and not tell anybody.
Yeah.
And he bucked that. He said, I can't do that. I can't just leave a war zone and not tell General Abrams. And just for the sake of continuity in the chain of command, I'm also going to tell SyncPAC. You know, I just can't up and abandon Saigon and leave it with the chief of staff while I go off to Washington, at least not without telling someone.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things about that.
So he was, you know, he was clearly being interviewed. People knew that. Tell you one other little story. I don't know if he remembers this or not. General Admiral McCain came to Saigon. I forget when it was. Probably, we're now talking in this early summer, late spring of 69. He came over on a regular basis because technically Abrams reported to him. Mm-hmm. Abrams reported to whomever he wanted to, but I mean, he technically, McCain was his boss.
McCain was SINCPAC.
SINCPAC. Okay. He was in charge of everything in the Pacific. And his son was a POW there.
Another senator.
The senator. When McCain came to Saigon, this time, the Admiral threw a party for him. And by the Abrams, General Brown, Ellsworth Bunker, who was the ambassador, the good pastor, who was the deputy. It was a galaxy, you know, of Saigon stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of, well, I was there at the table also, but coordinating the dinner and making sure everything got done correctly. And Abrams shows up with this entourage of machine gun laden cars, you know. And he always had an aide with him that, you know, carried an M1 rifle and 15 pistols and 37 hand grenades. And, you know, they were always, that's the Army, you know, we never did that. And General McCain, Admiral McCain shows up in the same and bunker. That was a big night for us. I mean, we had cars out there and we had more machine guns than we knew what to do with. So we were inside. And Abrams was telling stories about Bobby Kennedy and the Kennedys and when Meredith was being integrated into Ole Miss, and Abrams had been sent down to oversee and, you know, his telephone conversations with the Kennedys at the White. Kennedy was Attorney General, blah, blah, blah. They were, you know, people were just telling stories that night. Finally, General Abrams, Admiral McCain's wife would come with him occasionally. And I asked her once why she came, and she said she felt closer to her son. She was authorized to fly with him. Four stars could fly their wives around. Well, this time she brought her sister with her. They were identical twins. And you could tell it. I mean, they were, you know, they looked very much. So Abrams is sitting there and he's got this big cigar. And of course, McCain, he never took a cigar out of his mouth. He would eat, literally eat. Put food in his mouth and then put a cigar in his mouth and chew the food. So Zumwalt was always a great host. He got people engaged, you know. First conversation he asked us, who people had voted for in 69. Election. I was the only one at the table who voted for Humphrey. Everybody else voted for Nixon. And I remember I had to explain, you know, why I voted for Humphrey. Well, anyway, Abrams looks over at McCain. Said, I understand your wife's with you. He said, yeah. And that's exactly how he talked. He was real rough. But McCain was the perfect image of what an old admiral, you know, was supposed to be. He was rough, he was like sandpaper, you know. He had this gravel voice, and his father had been a four-star admiral, you know, and all this stuff. He says, I understand she's got her sister with her. I wondered why in the hell Abrams was interested in this. And he says, yeah. He says, I understand they're identical twins. And the Admiral pulled the cigar out of his mouth and says, that's right, Abe, what are you getting at? And he said, well, Admiral, I said, I was just wondering how you tell the difference when you go to bed at night. He says, God damn it, Abe, that's their problem, not mine. It was a phenomenal. Everybody just roared. I mean, the guy, it was just a wonderful repartee, mm-hmm. You know, to see these Ellsworth Bunker, this very stiff Ivy League diplomat. Abrams, who had been a tank commander with Patton, McCain, who had flown, you know, in the Second World War, Zumwalt the Young. I mean, it was quite a setting, mm-hmm. for me to be able to be there as a lieutenant, witness all this and participate in it. So we ended the evening with Ellsworth Bunker. When I was at Yale, he said, we used to finish. Nobody had been to Yale, knew where it was, you know. We used to always finish the evening off with everybody reciting a poem. We'd go around the table and everybody recite a poem. Unfortunately, when I was in high school, one of the things I had to do was to memorize it. I still remember it. So I was able to get through that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it was just one hell of an evening. And the only reason that evening even existed was because of what he had done. People had, see, that people would never have come to Vess. They wouldn't even have accepted an invitation. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. That had been stood up by Abrams before the change of command for a party or something. Abrams didn't show up, or I forget what it was. But I mean, see, Zumwalt had changed everything. They recognized him now as a substantive player at the highest levels. Repartee and everything, it really was a sort of a confirmation of a statue that someone had brought, you know, mm-hmm. to Vietnam, to the naval forces, himself, etc. So it was not only a lot of fun, but it was an affirmation, you know, of his status in Vietnam, mm-hmm. the respect that people had for him. Kane, Bunker, Abrams, Brown, all of them. Mm-hmm.
So when he became CNO, did you later on go back and work for him again?
I did. I went back to Washington in 71. He took over in June of 70. No, I didn't come back until 72. I kept in touch with him. And when I would come through town, I would go over to his quarters and meet with him or have lunch with him or something and talk about what was going on in the Navy. But it really wasn't anything significant. Then when I came back in 72, I went on what was called the CNO Executive Panel staff. It was a group of people that did, you know, service think tank, private think tank.
Mm-hmm. Was this directly a virtue of the fact that you had served with him in Vietnam?
He got you there. He had picked me for that job, and then I was only there for a year, and then I went to the White House. Stayed on with Vice President Ford, and then when Nixon resigned, I went to the White House and served President Ford until 76, and then I went back to the fleet. In fact, it's interesting, we were talking about that last night at dinner. This has nothing to do with Vietnam, but Zumwalt's departure from the Navy was quite filled with tension, and whether you probably haven't gotten to this, but General Haig ordered Zumwalt court-martialed.
Mm-hmm.
Did he tell you that?
I heard vaguely about that. I don't know the details.
Well, I was involved in that because I was at the White House at the time. So
mm-hmm.
When you get to that point, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. It's an interesting story. It's a true story, and it's something that is almost unprecedented.
Didn't somebody stop that long enough for him to be able to retire, which he was going to do anyway, with the change of command was coming?
Oh, no, the change of command was scheduled. And, Nixon was in Moscow, and Zumwalt had written a letter that bypassed the normal chain of command of the president.
To get around Kissinger?
Yeah, and he had sent a letter. And he sent me a copy of that letter to get to Ford. He won Ford there. So I had taken it and shown it to the vice president. See, the vice president had agreed to speak at his change of command. And I had written the speech for his change of command.
I know how much he locked horns with him with Kissinger, and so that was...
Yeah, and so the Haig had sent back a telegram to Secretary Schlesinger telling him not to go to the change of command, not to give Zumwalt a medal, and that he thought he should be court-martialed instead. And they didn't tell Ford not to go to the change of command. They recommended that he not go. Ford told me that he was going to go anyway, which he did.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't give the speech I had written. What was going on. We got up to Annapolis. We didn't know if Jim Schlesinger was going to show up or not. They did not give him the medal. Schlesinger did show up. It was the first time an outgoing member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff had never been given a
medal. So he never got the medal.
I don't know if he ever got it or not, but it was not given to him that day at the change of command.
This is all political, too.
I'm not doing justice. There's a lot to this.
Oh, sure.
There's a lot of background. And I was intimately not involved in the decision, but because Ford's involvement, and I was in the White House, and I was trying to keep Zumwalt informed, and you know, all this was going on. We were talking about it last night at dinner.
Well, when I get to that point, I would like to ask you about that.
See, I was also involved in the... I was in charge, if you will, of the transfer of the Navy's at his quarters to the Vice President, which is now the official residence of the Vice President.
It was a Naval Observatory.
Naval Observatory, and I was the person in charge of that. And there's a tremendous story there that involves Nixon's resignation. It deserves a...
What was your role in the White House under these different vice presidents and then...
To answer that, you have to understand that these were unusual times. And so a lot of times what your assigned role was had nothing to do with what you were doing. Because in the case of Ford, I was assigned over there as the military assistant. So the president, the vice president, is a statutory member of the Joint Chiefs of the National Security Council. And as such, you know, you have interface with the National Security Council staff. So. But Kissinger wouldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even invite Agnew to the meeting, so he didn't have a need for me. I used to brief him every morning. I'd go to the CIA at 5 in the morning and get briefed and then brief the vice president on what the hell was going on around the world. So that's all I did all day long. But then when Ford became vice president, he didn't have any congressional staff. And he'd gotten rid of the Agnew staff. Hagan fired everybody but me. And so all of a sudden, Ford's out traveling around the country, and I become the traveling chief of staff. I'm a naval officer interfacing with the Republican county chairman and doing a whole host of things that I'm really not, wasn't assigned to do and wasn't supposed to be doing. In fact, the military was concerned about my role. Then when Nixon resigned, I went over to the White House. Facing with Congress and the peoples. In fact, some of them had left the Navy by then. I was called over by the CNO, Admiral Holloway, and they, just to find out what the hell I was really doing in the White House. Nobody knew. And I had gone in to see the president, and I told him that the Navy was worried about me. He said, Howard, he said, I'm the commander-in-chief and you do whatever goddamn I tell you to do. I said, I understand that completely. he said, you tell your friends over the Navy just to not worry about anything. So, that's
a unique position to be in.
I was in a very unique position. It was, and let me say that I was phased out of that over time, you see, because, you know, as you bring in your own people and you put them in those positions and they start doing it. But during the transition and everything, you know, it was still the people, the Nixon people in the White House, and Ford knew me, I knew him, a sense of loyalty and confidence, and so you know, you end up doing things that, you know, that you were never assigned to do. And,
right.
And I didn't do that permanently. There was a period where I did a lot of things.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, this has nothing to do with the research or the story. I mean, having been in those positions, did that get you labeled as sort of political and have an influence on your career later that you wouldn't have liked?
Yes and no. When I left to the White House, I went back to command of the ship. And I think people saw that. You know, I could have gone anywhere I wanted to. The president would have given me any assignment that I wanted. In fact, he told me that.
Ford? Yeah.
So, but rather than take advantage of that, I went back to the fleet. And I think that was I had more problem when I went back to the fleet, though. It wasn't because I was labeled as political, I came from the White House. It was because I was a Zumwalt man. See, once Zumwalt left the Navy, the old Navy hands were determined to get rid of all the people that he had
sponsored.
There was a purge underway.
Was this fostered by the CNO as well, Holloway?
I don't think it was fostered by Holloway so much as it was just people that hated someone, felt that he had ruined the Navy. And so here was Howard Kerr, who had benefited from his sponsorship. I went to Hawaii to take command of a squadron. I went in for my welcome aboard from the admiral I was working for, and the first thing he said to me was, he started talking about Zumwalt. This was 1981. Zumwalt had left the Navy in 74.
Right.
7 years later.
Still haven't gotten over it.
Still hadn't gotten over it.
That's interesting. I mean, all the things that I've seen this week in the archive, all the discussions of different admirals, every one of them, there's no in between. They either love them or they hate them. I mean, there's just absolutely no in between. Yeah. And that's unusual.
What histories have you been reading?
Oh, good grief. Let me stop this.